The two scripture texts this morning can seem a little bit disjointed, just sitting next to each other, but a rabbinic tradition suggests that the widow in this morning's Second Kings reading was the wife of Obadiah in the First Kings reading, and that perhaps one of the reasons she was in a difficult financial situation was the generosity of her late husband. So from 1 Kings 18, verses 3 and 4, Ahab summoned Obadiah, who was in charge of the palace. Now Obadiah revered the Lord greatly. When Jezebel was killing off the prophets of the Lord, Obadiah took 100 prophets, hid them 50 to a cave, and provided them with bread and water. And then from 2 Kings 4, verses 1 through 7. Now the wife of a member of the company of prophets cried to Elijah, Your servant, my husband, is dead, and you know that your servant feared the Lord, but a creditor has come to take my two children as slaves. Elisha said to her, What shall I do for you? Tell me, what do you have in the house? She answered, Your servant has nothing in the house except a jar of oil. He said, Go outside, borrow vessels from all your neighbors, empty vessels, and not just a few. Then go in and shut the door behind you and your children and start pouring into all these vessels. When each is full, set it aside. So she left him and shut the door behind her and her children. They kept bringing vessels to her and she kept pouring. When the vessels were full, she said to her son, Bring me another vessel. But he said to her, There are no more. Then the oil stopped flowing. She came and told the man of God, and he said, Go, sell the oil and pay your debts, and you and your children can live on the rest.
Good morning. I am just returning from 3 days at the Wabash Pastoral Leadership Center. It's an amazing experience of 15 pastors, widely ecumenical group gathered from all around Indiana. It's a two-year commitment. We meet 12 times in those 2 years. The beginning of this week, we were talking about the economics of Indiana. It works well with this theme. Next time we gather, we'll be traveling to the U.S.-Mexico border for a learning tour in October. And following that, we'll be learning about education. When they told us about the education session, they said, just wait, it will be like a fire hose. And I thought, if this was not a fire hose, I don't know what's coming. I tell you that because I hope that I am not fire hosing you all, but I'm really excited about some of the things that I learned. And so you might have to hold on to your seats, and if you want a copy of what I wrote, I'm glad to share it. And I really did take it from 14 pages to only 5. So you're welcome. This morning's theme is sacrificial giving. And I hope that I can suggest and show that sacrifice in our tradition, sacrifice in the tradition of Jesus, is a way of life. A life of abundance, removed from the systems of power, removed from these systems that we are embedded in and live within. So let's begin with stories. We heard these two stories, and as Becky said, rabbinic tradition suggests that they are connected. I'm going to suggest that one teaches us something about the other. So now this is my retelling. Once there was a man named Obadiah. When he looked around, he saw lush fields and beautiful fruit trees, even though the season had passed. He did not see pods and husks and hulls. He saw the possibilities for seeds and new growth and life. He saw next year's harvest in the meadow of dried weeds. When he looked around, he saw a world cloaked in hope. He saw the glimmers of sunshine, and he felt that the gathering darkness and the stillness of the night were signs of rejuvenation, of a time for silence and for quiet shared moments. Now, Obadiah worked for the palace. He was the person who was the head of the business empire, the one who made all the arrangements, who took charge, the head servant who acts on behalf of the owner. And he was the administrator of King Ahab's residence. He lived in the world of business. He had to make sure things were done as they were supposed to. He had to take care of convenience, of cost and efficiency. They were important to the palace. And he did his work well. But those ideas of business, they were at the edge of his consciousness. They were not central to his internal and lived culture. You see, he was an Israelite. He was a follower of the 10 best ways of Moses. He knew that Egypt was a place his ancestors had escaped from and then longed for in their complexity. He remembered and told the stories of his people in the wilderness, of his people full of uncertainty and wishing for Egypt, the place they had been enslaved, but that was the place they knew. And Obadiah was on the other side of that, and he looked back with his people and believed that the time in the wilderness, the time of shared trial and grief, that time God was with his people. And not just that time, because God always was there. But he knew it was in the wilderness where they saw God most clearly. He knew there that God provided miracles, gave food, and had a way always be open. So when Jezebel, who was Ahab's wife, convinced her husband to abandon the worship of Yahweh and kill all the prophets, Obadiah, we are told, took 100 of them and hid them in 2 caves. And he provided them with food and with water. He never saw scarcity. When Obadiah looked around, there was always enough. Enough for 100 more. 100 prophets hidden in a cave. Obadiah lived out of his sense of abundance, out of his sense that God would be there in the wilderness where there appeared to be nothing. And after he died, his wife was left. To be left alone in this society as a woman was not good. How would she provide for her family? How would she provide for her children? Obadiah had given so much, and there was so little left. In her grief, she despaired. She saw scarcity. She saw that Obadiah's sacrifice had become her loss. She looked around. She saw that she was not safe. Her children were going to be taken away. And she's not alone. For all of us despair. Especially when the world around us, when politics and economics and distorted religion collude to tell us that there's not enough. That we will fail, that we will never add up, that our children will be taken. And when we hear that, our capacity to function shrivels. And we cannot see what is around us. We abandon the sense and the knowledge that in the wilderness, there are options. There are others with us. We lose track of our community, our place, our God, and there is no alternative future. There is only more of the same. In this place of despair, there can be no interruption, no miracle, no surprise, no gift, and no prophecy. And then she grieved. She entered the pain. She saw around her help. And she saw Elisha. And maybe in him she saw a glimmer of what had been and what could be again. In crying out for help, I imagine in that grief, she deeply saw the impossibility of perfection, of immortality, that her husband could still be with her. Our grief connects us with our pain, but our grief is alive. It is full of sense. It is proof of our connection and our relatedness to each other. Grief is vulnerability and opens us to mystery that we can't understand with our minds. And so she reached to Elisha for help. And Elisha asked her to look around and see the possibilities, to see the seeds and the new growth instead of the pods and the husks and the hulls, to see next year's harvest in the meadow of dry weeds. He called her to see things cloaked in hope and glimmers of sunshine, and to see the gathering darkness and stillness of the night as a chance for rejuvenation, a time for silence and quiet shared moments. Elisha asked her, "What do you have?" And she looked around and found a jar of oil, and she opened herself to the mystery and miracle. And then she remembered her community, and she sent her children to the neighbors, and they collected every empty pot and jar they had, each one offering something. And she went into her house, and with her children, they began to pour the oil into one jar after another, and another, and another. And it was not until each pot and jar was full that the oil stopped flowing, and she was able to pay the debt and have enough for later. The big story of 1 and 2 Kings is a story about the Israelites moving from the wilderness to the kingdom. And they begin at the beginning that the wilderness is the place they didn't want to be, and the kingdom is what they long for. And as the story goes on, it is described by Kate Huey as a long historical account of kings leading up to Ahab, a rather grim narrative of successions and wars, infidelities and punishments on its way to the disgrace that was Ahab and Jezebel. And into this story, two prophets, Elisha and Elijah, are placed. Every time in these stories, the prophets remind people about God's presence in the wilderness. Where there was nothing, there is something. There is mystery. There is an interruption. There is a surprise. They point to a way of living that is very different than the worn out, despair-producing way of thinking and acting that is the world of the kings, and the way of the consumer culture, I would say, that surrounds us. It is no wonder that Jesus stirred the memory of these prophets of Israel in his followers. The earthly kingdom that Jesus lived in had its own way of doing things, its own customs and policies regarding food and money and sex and family and religion. And ours does too. We are so steeped in it that sometimes it is hard to look on the outside of it. It's the air we breathe. And like in the story I told of Obadiah, we, like him, need to know about speed and convenience and cost and efficiency. They're important in our world. And I would like to suggest some of the ways that we can move those ideas to the edge of our consciousness. They don't stop existing, but perhaps they are removed from what is the center of the culture that we are creating. To do this, I'm going to rely heavily on this book, Another Kingdom. It's by Peter Block and John McKnight, who are community organizers, and Walter Brueggemann, who is an Old Testament scholar. It is a handy 95-page book that I hope we have a chance as a community to talk more about. And there is a copy in the library. You're also welcome to look at my tattered copy. I believe that our consumer and market economy is based on functional atheism. That is, the despair that says it's better in Egypt, where we know what we can have, than in the wilderness, where God is present. This functional atheism insists on despair that doesn't end, on despair that doesn't move to grief, on despair that says you can be immortal, anything is possible. It insists that only we are responsible for everything that happens. There's no room for mystery or miracles or silence or gift or surprise. There's no room and no time. Every relationship is based on a contract, and contracts are based on an exchange of interests. Everything needs a date, a dollar sign, and you need to know exactly what is expected and what will be given and returned. If a contract is broken, there are ways to go about getting what we need, ways to have the debt repaid. In the Hebrew Bible, we learn about covenants and vows. Covenants that God make with the people of Israel. And I would like to suggest that living in a covenant puts the economics of the culture beside us. Covenant is an act of imagination. Brueggemann and all, they say you can't point to a covenant. A contract, you can point to the details, but you can only point to a specific performance of covenant. Generosity, for example, is a specific performance of covenant. Another example, we're most familiar with the marriage vow. The marriage vow is an act of relationship and neighborliness where we choose to give care to someone who has no claim on us. It's an act of fidelity that we can easily avoid. We don't have to make that vow. In that vow, if you made it contractual and listed out everything you would manage and have to deal with in your marriage vow, you likely wouldn't sign that contract, let's say. The two of them go on. They say, a covenant, though, is not without risks. It demands reciprocity over time, and violating covenant has consequences. For example, loss of trust and consequent isolation. Covenant is a different way of ordering social relationships. It leads to a more intimate, more interdependent way of being. If we want to live the way of Jesus, a way of sacrifice, this is a way of generosity and abundance that makes room at the center for those outside. We need to replace our contracts in daily life with vows. We need to decide if we will trust another person's vow. We need to become known to each other and our community. A covenant promises an unknowable world. A covenant promises the wilderness. It is organized for surprise, and it believes that much of life is permanently unknowable. And then together, we can gather in this new way of being, with the way of the world operating beside us, but in our periphery. And we can look for ways to make that vow visible, to gather in mystery and make that mystery concrete. When we do that, we open a door to a set of communal disciplines, disciplines of time, silence, shared food, and I would say re-performance. More on those later. The disciplines lead us on a path that begin and end in mystery. These people, believing in mystery is the initial act of departure. It is the doorway to the alternative future. It's an opening to creativity and imagination. It opens the door to a neighborhood or a community organized by covenant. Our stewardship series, then, is an opportunity to use this rich theological heritage and language to delve deep into the nuances and challenges of living in a culture of scarcity, a culture that demands that we keep for ourselves and make sure that we have enough, not just for today, but for tomorrow, too. We are challenged to recognize the paradox of living in a culture and trying to be separate from it. Isn't this the challenge and our heritage as Anabaptists? To recognize that what is for our own good is also for the good of our neighbor and the planet. This is a way that sees possibility and imagination. Our consumer culture takes the aliveness out of the world. I think it removes the sense from it. In death, you don't get to use your senses anymore. We say people are brain dead because their senses are useless. Sometimes I think that in our culture and technology that surrounds us, these are ways of systematically limiting our senses. It's nonsense. It's nonsense. The alternative is to have senses, to turn toward each other, to turn toward the world that we can see and taste and touch and feel, to turn toward a life of generosity and community, toward abundance. Christian Smith is a sociologist, not a theologian, from Notre Dame, and he says that generosity is the virtue of giving good things to others freely and abundantly. It's learned, he says, and it involves both an attitude and an action. It's both inclination and actual practice. It's not just giving something, but feeling like you want to. More importantly, he says, it's not a haphazard behavior, but a basic orientation to life. I would say a sacrificial life. What generosity gives, he says, can vary. It can be money, possessions, time, attention, aid, encouragement, but it always wants to enhance the well-being of the receiver. It operates, I say, out of abundance. It operates out of our deep claim that God says, you are enough. You are enough. And therefore, you have enough. What a resistance to the world that says, you don't have enough. You need more. Therefore, you'll never be enough. So what would it mean if here at Assembly we looked around for all the pots in our community, the community gathered here and the community outside our doors? What would our radical hospitality goal look like if we were in the business of gathering pots and pouring out oil? Here's one small example. That's small but very radical, I think. At Broadway United Methodist Church in Indianapolis, they have hired on their staff a community listener. The job of the community listener is to go into their church community and out into the neighborhood and ask people a simple question. What do you know well enough to teach others? And people say things like motorcycle repair, or fishing, or cooking, or being kind. And then they offer their space at Broadway United Methodist to teach these things. Nobody pays, you just come in and the teacher teaches some things and the learners can give a donation if they want. But their space is a space for learning. What if in our community we had 30 families, 30 households in our community or on the block that each had four things they could teach? That would be 120 things that we could teach right here. That would be pretty cool. Imagine if we open ourselves to an understanding that there are gifts everywhere. There are gifts where you can't even see them. Then we begin to see abundance all around us. And if we imagine sharing these gifts, we build a culture of hospitality. I think a key to covenant is to seeing the gifts of the widow, her small pitcher of oil, and seeing the gifts of the immigrant, and anyone on the margin. And the exposure of gifts to each other is the way to the kind of community that we want. When we function in abundance, we lose our atheism because we have to believe that even in this world, God is present in the gifts that we can't see. We begin to believe that the world and the material universe that we live in are God made flesh. God is immanent and transcendent. But there is a possibility everywhere for hope and inbreaking, for imagination and change, that God is here. When we begin to see the wilderness that we name sometimes our culture and living in this despair as a wilderness where God is present, then we get to see the hope and possibility. A liturgy is a regularly performed script that in its performance promises to change us. A liturgy is more powerful than a map because a map pretends there's a destination that we can get to. A liturgy is just a performative act that we believe will change us. In our Christian tradition, some of the liturgical elements that we use are praise and confession, thanksgiving. We say that these things change us. If we think about neighborliness and covenant and relationship with others, I want to think that that could be a liturgy, a performance that promises to change us. It's an opportunity every day and in every encounter to perform an alternate liturgy to the world. We can know that life, as we live it, is a performance of a deathly, nonsensical liturgy, or the possibility of something alive. Maybe we can engage in our daily living in a liturgy of aliveness, a liturgy in favor of the common good. This book, The Other Kingdom, suggests three areas to lean into that as an alternative liturgy. I'd like to think of these as three more areas for hospitality, three more areas where we live the practice of sacrifice of Jesus. The first is the countercultural practice of silence. Silence as bringing people together. Silence reminds us we're not alone. When people gather and we sit together, the right questions bring the sacred into the room. When we ask questions that are an invitation to hear each other, something sacred is created. The second is a lesson from the margins, that there is enough time. In consumer society, time is a scarcity. We don't have time for that. That's an argument against collaboration, against collectivism, against participation. Time as abundance is deeply countercultural. And the third they suggest is food. Our covenantal community relies on the practice of sacred food, the bread and the cup. It is part of who we are in the Christian community. It's the first meal that we practice over and over. I think, though, that food shared is a regular and concrete performance of gratitude. And the communion table is the place where all are equal and gather together. But every table, I think every festival, every community gathering has that possibility of sacred food. Serious communities, they say, are always developing and sustaining their sacramental practices, which the commodity system cannot possibly do, because control is the antithesis of mystery. Serious communities, I say, make sacrifices of time, food, and silence. They are real and vulnerable together. They go on retreat together. Maybe they hold block parties in their new parking lot. They share work. They share space. Maybe they have art and music events in their lovely space. Maybe they host and teach entrepreneurial skills. Maybe they shop and spend their dollars locally and close by. They grow food and gardens. They have mentors, and they connect elders with children, and they learn the names of those children. Maybe they meet once a week for worship or coffee. They affirm and expand associational life. All of these practices embed us in place. They connect us with each other. They are moments of departure from the consumer culture. They situate our human community as a place of bottomless mystery, a place where time and imperfection and silence and covenant are elements of life together. You see, it isn't just that there is enough. It's the practice, the sacrificial practice of Jesus, that is a belief in abundance that makes more available. Theologically, what that means is that if we practice abundance, God gives more. Love has the same effect. If you can't think of God giving more, think of love. Love produces more of itself. Do you see how the light never gets smaller? In these faithful acts of silence and time and sharing food together, in these metaphors and practices that we have in corporate worship, in our 2% offering, our gifts to the window, the practice of our shared meal of communion, we enact the alternative community. We enact the intimacy and the urgency of daily living, of potluck, of communion. And we enter the imaginative sacramental act of abundance. There is abundance. There is enough for all. Wild Geese by Wendell Berry. Horseback on Sunday morning, harvest over, we taste persimmon and wild grape, sharp, sweet of summer's end. In time's maze over fall fields, we name that went west from here, names that rest on graves. We open the persimmon seed to find a tree that stands in promise, pale in the seed's marrow. Geese appear high over us, pass, and the sky closes. Abandon, as in love or sleep, holds them on their way, clear in the ancient faith. What we need is here. And we pray not for new earth or new heaven, but to be quiet in the heart and in the eye clear. What we need is here. Amen.